Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars to serve the church as a center of cultural and civic renewal. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we begin, I'd like to open with a prayer, and this one is from the Book of Common Prayer, and it's specifically a prayer for our nation, and which I think is fitting for today's episode. So please join me. Almighty God, who has given us this good land for our heritage, we humbly beseech thee that we may always prove ourselves a people mindful of thy favor and glad to do thy will. Bless our land with honorable industry, sound learning, and pure conduct. Save us from violence, discord, and confusion, from pride and arrogance, and from every evil way. Defend our liberties and fashion into one united people, the multitudes brought hither out of many kindreds and tongues. And do with the spirit of wisdom those to whom, in thy name, we entrust the authority of government, that there may be justice and peace at home, and that, through obedience to thy law, we may show forth thy praise among the nations of the earth. In the time of prosperity, fill our hearts with thankfulness, and in the day of trouble, suffer not our trust in thee to fail. All of which we ask through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Well, as you can see, I'm joined once again by a familiar face here on The Sower, John D. Wilsey. John, I'm not going to do your whole bio, so we'll just say he's a Georgia native living with his wife and kids in Louisville, Kentucky. And more trivially, he is a professor of church history and philosophy and chair of the Department of Church History and Historical Theology at the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's written a bunch of stuff, which I've been obligated to read out of friendship and loyalty. And today, we're going to specifically talk about his new book, God and Country, Upholding Faith, History, and National Identity, published by B&H Academic Press in 2026. Another reason not to read your whole bio is because a lot of this book is actually autobiographical, I noticed, and that adds a lot of personality to the book. It's always funny when I read stuff by you, I can hear your voice. It's like an automatic audiobook. It's also what I see.
What a pleasant thing.
it depends what you're saying, actually. It's also what I see as a kind of distinctively Christian historiography or historical hermeneutic, if you will. So I want to start with this question. Why this book? Why now?
Well, our dear mutual friend, Stephen Presley, and I were sitting out around a fire at his house one night with a bunch of his PhD students. There were probably 8 or 10 of them sitting around the fire. And we were talking about America, and they were talking about Christian nationalism and how that was, growing. This is a few years ago. This would have been 2021, 2022. Mm-hmm. How it was a growing issue in their churches. And so Stephen looked at me and he said, "You should write a book about this for pastors." So that's the reason why I wrote it. Yeah. it's a long story, I guess, longer than that, but how it came to be. But that's the short version. I wanted to make a write a book length treatment on it that would be accessible for pastors, church leaders, Christian school teachers, people in the church, people who are interested in the church. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the book came from.
Now, the whole book is focused on, I shouldn't say the whole book, but most of it is focused on the importance of history and why we study it, mm-hmm. why you study it as well. But you define history specifically as, quote, the way we make sense of the past. Now, I'm not a professional historian. I that's what I should have majored in. But I'm just wondering if that...
Everybody says that.
That's right. Everybody says that later on. But it's the way we make sense of the past. Is that a controversial definition? I'm just curious about that.
I haven't had any controversy with it. Maybe that's because nobody's reading the book. Nobody cares. But that could be. But I've never... when I teach my history courses, I usually open my classes with that as a definition for history. I've never had anybody say, "I don't like that definition." My favorite definition, I talk about it in the book, is by John Lukacs, where he calls history the remembered past. And he uses that, he says that in his book, Historical Consciousness. And then he also has another definition, and I'm pretty sure I put it in this week. I can't remember if it was in Religious Freedom or in this one. He also said history is the memory of mankind. And his point with that is that human beings are the only creatures that that remember the past. Other creatures, of course, have some kind of, memory of the past. Animals can, remember things, I guess, but they don't intentionally do that. They don't build memorials. They don't mark battlefields. They don't write books.
Right.
They don't argue over a historical method. And also, animals don't have aspirations for the future.
Yeah.
So they don't know their place in time, like human beings do. And that is an indication of our having been made in God's image, and our uniqueness.
I think an alternative definition, which would be completely averse to what you're saying here, is thinking of history instead as the way we make use of the past. I'm not saying that it's useless, but at the same time, right, there
negative.
Is a danger.
Controversial.
Yeah, that would be more controversial in
that
the
would
sense
be more
that.
Controversial.
And I
Because
think that's also. Go ahead.
The idea of a usable past is discussed a lot. And if you, if you use the past, for example, for a particular ideology to advance an ideology, you're not really doing history anymore. You're doing politics.
Right.
And that's your field.
Supposedly, right.
That's
Once
what
upon a time.
You political people, y'all, that's what y'all do. Y'all use the past.
When it's convenient, right? That's when it's
Exactly.
convenient. And when it's not convenient, we just ignore it. I'm just kidding. Obviously that's not true of me, but I definitely have seen that happen, right? It's
Sure.
let's cherry pick from the past so we can paint the picture we want to paint. Which is not what you're doing in this book, and I'm grateful for that. I was surprised by your first chapter in particular, and this might go back to the origins of why you wrote the book, because I am not someone, as you know, who has, I don't have to be persuaded that history is relevant and important to study. And you specifically went about this to give a biblical rationale for the study of history. What's that about? Why even bother with that? I mean, you encounter this more often than I do. Why do this way?
Well, I like to say that, I teach at a seminary, and I like to say, and I say this to the students, that that history at a seminary is often treated like the chicken on a fancy seafood restaurant menu. You go to a fancy seafood restaurant, and you don't go for the chicken.
Right.
The chicken is going to be good. You're going to enjoy it if you don't like seafood, but that's not why you go there. And a lot of people come to seminary, they don't come for history. Most people don't come for history. Most people come to study Bible and theology. They don't come from it for history. History is something that they're interested in. They may come around to history as the longer they spend, in their program of study, or they may leave seminary and still not care. But I want to make the case in the biblical rationale chapter that that's not really an option for especially a Christian, because our faith is historical, and so we think historically because we're made in God's image. We think historically as Christians because our whole faith is built on things that happened in the past, and so thinking historically and being engaged in history, having and cultivating a historical consciousness, as John Lukacs would say, is central to who we are as image bearers and who we are as redeemed children of God.
How does that, because you've been a pastor, how has your disposition or practice of historical thinking been influential on you as a pastor? I mean, what would you not just in seminary, but once you graduate seminary and you're going, you're leading a church, why would knowing history matter?
Well, there's a lot of things I could say about that. One thing that I can say to respond to that question is pastors, preachers, for some reason, enjoy using the term post-Christian to assess the state of affairs in our culture. And personally, I don't like that term. I don't like that as a category, because it is a category that reveals a lack of knowledge about history and a lack of good thinking about history.
Okay.
Because what it implies is that the church has never been through what we're going through now. And that's not the case. That this is all brand new, and that we're all just sort of stumbling around trying to feel our way through. You know, that's just not true.
Yeah.
It's not true. I mean, anybody who knows anything about church history knows it's not true. I'd say that all the people that use that term know that that's not true, but they haven't thought about it deeply enough to come up with a different term. It's like a lot of terms that we use in our culture. Somebody uses a pithy term and everybody latches onto it, like lean in.
Yeah.
And everybody loves that expression. Oh my gosh, I hate that expression. You know, somebody said it once and now everybody says it, and that's all that anybody ever says, and they can't think of anything else to say.
It's like the recent phrase locked in. Have you been hearing this?
Locked
one?
In. Oh my gosh. Yes. That's a new one.
Yeah.
It's a new one. Josh. And also, here's another one. Bro.
Bruh.
I had a student call me.
It's B-R-U-H. You know,
that's even worse. I had a student call me that the other day. You can't call me that.
Doctor Bruh. That's what I think I actually had a student call me that once because I, yeah. I use that word all the time. I can't.
Do you?
Depends.
My daughter will say that to me.
That's kind of funny.
It is kind of funny.
But all right. Well, that's interesting. I'm guilty of using the phrase post-Christian, but you're right. I mean, there's nothing new under the sun in that respect. I think
ahead. The reason why I bring it up is because your question was about, you know, where does history fit into, you know, pastoral ministry, preaching ministry, you know, in sort of an ordinary everyday sense. And that's one example. In our engagement with the culture, we have to understand the culture, how we got to the place where we are now. And to do that, we have to understand the history of the ideas and the people and the events that inhabited cultures past that, you know, brought this culture into existence, where this culture emerged from. And I think that the use of that term is bad because it reveals either an apathy about the past and how we got here. It reveals an ignorance about it. It certainly reveals bad historical thinking. And if we're bad historical thinkers about this, then we're going to be bad historical thinkers about the New Testament world and the things that matter to our salvation and to our sanctification as well. So I think it matters a great deal.
I would also add the way history plays a role in pastoring, in a sense, in a place, right? I mean, whenever you're pastoring a place, you are pastoring a people, but you're also very much responding to the history of a particular location, right? I think there's, depending on where you've lived, you know, there might be some trauma in that community that you may not have been part of, right? You're coming into the town, maybe you've been called to that church, but you don't know why this particular disposition seems to dominate, or there's tension between these groups of people in that town because there's been there's a history there. And I think there's definitely something to that. That if you don't know the place you're pastoring, it's gonna be very, very hard to do it. It's like a shepherd who's trying to take a bunch of sheep into a terrain that they've never been to, or they've never seen, or don't know how to handle. So,
well, that's a great metaphor.
Now, the way you'd frame better historical thinking, better thinking in general, frankly, is you talk about virtue, which we'll get to later, but you also talk about your five C's: change over time, context, causality, contingency, complexity. I'd like to just talk about each of these briefly. And you give a lot of great anecdotes in the book, so feel free to bring those in to the episode here. But and also just thinking about how these help us, maybe with that metaphor we just talked about, understanding a place. So let's start with change over time. What do you mean by that in the context of historical thinking?
Yeah. By the way, the five C's of historical thinking, that is not my idea.
Mm-hmm.
I make sure that I do all of my citations correctly in my book.
Like I just don't read
tell
them.
My students to do. Well, that's okay. but I do want to make sure that I'm clear that that's not my idea. It's not original to me. It's actually been talked about for a couple of decades.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll set the table by saying that. But I think it's brilliant, and I teach the five C's. It's the first lecture I give in every history class. I teach it at the seminary. But change over time is historians study change over time because the world of the past is foreign to us. Maybe the classic error that we make when we think about the past is to be presentist or to be anachronistic about it. You probably get questions like this. I get questions like this sometimes. What would Alexis de Tocqueville think about Trump? Or, what would Thomas Jefferson thought about? What would he have thought about secession?
Mm-hmm.
Would he have supported that? Well, that's an impossible question to answer. It's a question that's rooted in a assumption of continuity, in the sense that the world that we inhabit today, Trump's world, is completely unchanged from the 1830s, the world of Tocqueville, so that he would be able to recognize our world and it would be exactly the same as his world, and he would be able to write a book, Democracy in America, and have it set in 2026
yeah,
instead
yeah.
of in 1835. Gets us into all kinds of problems. Change over time is, you think about if you go to Japan, a different country, you have to adapt yourself to that culture. You have to adapt yourself to their ways of life. You don't insist that they adapt themselves to you when you're a guest in their country. And same is true for history. You have to sort of put yourself in their shoes. You have to kind of live in their world a little bit. Understand that world is different. Now, there are continuities, but they're real broad continuities. Human nature is the same, and death is always going to be a powerful consideration. Death is a invisible presence in the lives of every person that's ever lived, and that's on full display when you look at history. It's also true for us. Anyway, so that's a little bit about change over time.
Yeah, and so in a way, you're not denying pieces of general continuity, right? There are universals that transcend time, but we don't want to. Is it the word casuistry, or anachronism is a better word, where essentially
mm-hmm.
you're assuming that context is continuous, which is your next term.
Which is the next term?
Yeah, and
Yeah.
that to me is very straightforward, but we seem to miss this a lot. How is it different from what you just said, though? Because
context.
Yeah, how is it different from what you just said?
Context has to do with background. So the illustration I use with my students in the seminary, for example, when we start talking about the Reformation, what kind of a world did Martin Luther emerge out of?
Mm-hmm.
So was he a modern, or was he a pre-modern? Was he a medieval person, or is he like us? And the answer to that is pretty obvious. He's a pre-modern. He's a medieval person. He has a medieval mindset. For example, he sees a bolt of lightning strike an oak tree, and he prays to St. Margaret and St. Anne. We see a bolt of lightning, and we film it on our smartphone, and we post it on social media, and we say, wow, isn't this amazing?
Yeah.
And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that, but I'm just pointing out that his response is different than ours because his worldview is different. He thought about reality differently than we think about it today. And in order to understand change over time in a particular time period, say a lifespan, you have to know something about the background and what's going on in the world. How do people look at reality? How do people think about reality in that time? There's a really good book that does this well that I'll recommend. You might have read it, called A World Lit Only by Fire, by William Manchester.
No, I never heard of that. No.
It's about he writes it about the medieval mind and the Renaissance. And the first 100 pages or so of that book, he gives us his background on the medieval West. And the way he does it is he describes daily life for ordinary people and also not ordinary people, kings and aristocrats. But he gives us a picture of daily life and how people thought about reality and how people thought about time and the passage of time. And he also gives the reader a very specific, almost picturesque view of how long the medieval world lasted.
Yeah.
How long it was. 1,000 years. For us, we say 1,000 years. We really don't have a frame of reference for that kind of span of time. And so that book is a great example of a historian setting up context for, you know, ultimately what he's going to try to accomplish in the book. And so it's background. Another illustration I use, which is which students can latch on to, is in the Star Wars movies, there's a opening crawl in every one of the movies. And, you know, in 1977, that was pretty innovative. And it was also necessary in 1977 because that genre was so new. And because if they hadn't had it, then there would have been no frame of reference to understand what was going on in the story. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, Star Wars, the first, you know, 77, whatever, A New Hope, Episode 4, starts in the middle of a battle.
Yeah.
So you can't, if you're just dropped in the middle of that, you don't know who these people are. You don't know what's going on. You don't know who the protagonists are. But the opening crawl gives you context. And since history is ultimately a story, context is necessary. Background is necessary.
How about causality? That's your next C. Where are you going with that?
Well, where I'm going with that is God established, when he created the universe, the cosmos, he created a cause and effect system. He is, you know, Aquinas famously talks about God as the first cause, getting that from Aristotle, of course. And I think that that's much more significant than just, oh, this is an argument for God's existence. I think it has a real historical significance to it as well. Because our system, our whole system, is a cause and effect system. And in the Enlightenment, David Hume, of course, famously denied that cause and effect relationships were ontological. That, you know, we assign cause and effect by through experience, but they're not necessary to ontology. But that's not what Aquinas thought, and I think that I think that Hume was wrong. And if that's true, then the study of cause and effect relationships is so important to history because it shows us that everything in history, whether we know those details or not, and whether we care or not, whether we're entertained by them or not, are all relevant to us. So even the most obscure events of the past mean something to us. They're not just they're not just random tales for your 11th grade history class. That's all you want to do is get out of there.
Yeah.
Everything has a history. So the way we think today, the way that we respond to the culture, kind of what I was getting back to earlier with post-Christian term, Everything has a history. Everything has a reason for the way that it is today. And the things that are happening now are causes for future events. And in good historical thinking, you trace those cause and effect relationships.
This may bring us into the next C, which is contingency, but sticking with causality for a moment, does that understanding of causality undermine the notion of free will? Now, I don't think that's where you're going, but I could imagine someone hearing this and be like, well, I guess we're just stuck in this train of things happening, right? And of course, being at a, you know, we always had the issue of predestination, right? That you don't need to go down that road necessarily, but is history just a way of, you know, showing that we're not actually free? Things are going to happen with us or without us. It's you know, and we're just got to deal with it.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. And we would get into that in contingency, but I mean, it's just it's a classic tension that Christians have dealt with for 2,000 years. The tension between the sovereignty of God and the free will and responsibility of man. The choices that we make in the present are choices that matter, the choices that have consequences. Within a cause and effect order that God made by his sovereignty, and in which God is imminent in the created order, bringing to pass the things that are his will. So I think you could end up being a fatalist. Lots of people in history have been fatalists, have been hard determinists. Mm-hmm. I don't think that this take on cause and effect is necessarily leads that way.
Mm-hmm.
And for the reason why, you know, contingency, which is the fourth C, I think that's the cautionary note that goes with cause and effect. Contingency has to do with human free will. And it reminds us that providence, while we believe in providence and we hold to the doctrine of providence, we can actually say that things in the past happened by God's providence. We know that because they happened. But we don't know God's mind, and we don't know God's reasons and purposes for exercising his providential care in the ways that he does, because he doesn't tell us, unless it's in Scripture, in which he does tell us. But that's no longer really the same kind of history. That's special revelation. It's not general revelation. So contingency stresses human free will. You're faced with choice. You'll be faced with a whole bunch of choices today, you know, whether or not to put gas in your car today. Your car is on getting close to the E, but you're running late for a meeting. Do I stop and fill up with gas, or do I just press on? And you decide to just, you know, I think I'm just going to try to get there and be on time for the meeting. And then you run into traffic and you're sitting there and your car runs out of gas. Mm-hmm. If you had gotten gas, I mean, everybody knows how to have this feels, you know, oh, if I'd only done this, if I'd only chosen this, then I could have avoided, you know, this particular set of bad circumstances. The thing is that when you're faced with a choice, you don't know how, you don't know what the consequences were going to be. You have good hopes for things that you decide, but you don't know how it's going to turn out. That's true for everybody in the past as well. They don't know what the outcome's going to be when they make a choice. And so it gives us a measure of humility when we look at the decisions that people made in the past, the consequences that that came out of those choices that they made, being, you know, emerging in the events and the ideas that come out of those things. All that is part of historical contingency, and I do think that historical contingency is good for us to avoid the pitfalls of a hard determinism, or by assigning, you know, sort of a God of the gaps theory about explaining things that we don't understand in the past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Your last C is complexity, which I think in many ways speaks for itself. But I wanted to read this one quote that I thought was important because it's an easy objection to bring up, but also one that I think you respond to well. You write, historical complexity should not be used as an excuse for laziness in historical research, nor should it be sought after as a cover from some postmodern rejection of truth. biblical ethics and epistemology are sufficient guides against these excesses. I'd like you to comment on that, because it's easy to see that anything we're dealing with historically is always more complex. It's just not, you know, a black and white narrative, good versus evil, powerful versus powerless. That's not always what we're dealing with here. But you say biblical ethics and epistemology are sufficient guides against those two excesses. What do you mean by that?
I think that I mean to say that it's just real easy for us to look at history as kind of like Star Wars, kind of like a story of good guys and bad guys. I mean, Americans love, you know, stories of good versus evil. Maybe that's human nature. Maybe it's more than just Americans, but Americans love that. It's not just Star Wars. I mean, you know, Westerns, you go back to the 50s, you know, the early years of TV and also the big screen, you know, like a good Western, you have the black hats and the white hats, you know, cowboys and Indians. Mm. Cowboys are the good guys. The Indians are the bad guys. I mean, Americans love those kinds of stories. And Hollywood has made scads of money on those kind of narratives, you know, but history is not like that. History is not Star Wars. It's not Lord of the Rings, you know,
whatever.
Those are appealing to us because they're simple narratives. And not only are they simple narratives, but they appeal to our impulse towards self-righteousness, because we always will identify with the good guys and say, those are our people. Mm-hmm. And the bad guys, those are those other people, and we must destroy them. We must completely defeat them, annihilate them. And I think it's particularly pernicious today when we have such hyper-partisanship. Even though look at the ways that the Civil War is being interpreted today versus how it was interpreted for most of the 20th century. So Tim Kaine, our erstwhile vice presidential candidate from 2016, thank goodness he wasn't elected. sorry to get political, but he, a couple of weeks ago, proposed a bill in the Congress to take Robert E. Lee's name off of Arlington House at mm-hmm. Arlington National Cemetery, because Arlington House was designated as the Robert E. Lee Memorial. And so his rationale for this was that we need to have people we can look up to, and people that are going to represent the values that we have. And certainly, there's truth to that. I can latch on to a lot of what he says about that. But like it or not, this is the complexity of history part of it. Like it or not, Robert E. Lee actually does represent American values in certain ways, mm-hmm. because he's there.
Yeah.
And you can't get rid of him. You can take his name off, and maybe they will. Maybe they'll take his name off of Arlington House, and life will go on. You know, I'm not going to be out there with my Confederate flag saying, protesting. That's not going to be me.
Which Wilsey, by the way, does not have a Confederate flag, as you can see back there. He has a 200-year-old gun behind him. But
it's a vain, futile, self-righteous move to say, if we just get rid of this name, then that means that we're going to be able to get back to pursuing the values that we all hold dear, whatever those are, because he doesn't define them. And of course, cultural values change. Mm-hmm. The values that we hold today are not going to be the values we hold in a generation. They're not. Mm-hmm. The values that our parents held are not the values we hold today. And that is good, bad, and indifferent. I mean, there's good things and bad things and neutral things about those changes over time. But my point in all this is to say that history is not a story of good guys versus bad guys. It's a complex story. It's not a simple narrative. And the people that we don't like in the past, that we want to reject in the past, or don't want to emulate, they're not going away. Even if we stop writing books about them, take all the memorials down, take all the statues down, no matter who it is, those people are always going to be there because they shaped the world that we live in now, in some way, good things, bad things, again, neutral ways, things that we don't know. This is where cause and effect comes in. A life like Robert E. Lee's matters because the things that he did still reverberate today. Everything about his life is incredibly relevant to today. History is always relevant.
Well, I think with Robert E. Lee in particular, and we can move here into the question of virtue, right? It's saying he's relevant, saying he's important is not the same as endorsing his views of slavery, right? And that's what drives me nuts, is that I can't, especially in the context of a college classroom and the ones I've been in with in more pagan institutions, if you will, it was just black and white. Either you hate Robert E. Lee or
you're
pro slavery.
A slaveholder.
Yeah, which is just ridiculous. It's such a ridiculous thought.
Horrible.
It's a very unintelligent way to think, quite frankly. But this actually, I think this is a good segue into the next section of your book, which it deals with virtue. So you give your five C's, history matters and the biblical rationale. And then you go into virtue and you go into the theological virtues and classical ones. And here I'm grateful you use a lot of Cicero, which makes sense given the topic of virtue. I'm wondering though, and again, I don't want to give away everything in the book. I want people to read this without going through the whole catalog of virtues again. Is there a danger here? Because on the one hand, I think of it this way. You have kind of the impact of Marxism and critical theory on historiography, which has been to actually, they're imposing their own particularly moral narrative and concepts of justice on the way we make sense or use the past. So they're not necessarily using the word virtue, but because you specifically say that historical thinking is not just intellectual, it's also moral. Well, why is the John Wilsey way and the John Wilsey moral history, if you will, any different than, I should say, any better or worse or more historically valid than, say, that of the Marxist or the critical theorist? Because you can go back and say, look, there's the powerful and the powerless, the oppressed and the oppressor. Like, that's the way to, one way to categorize history and being both, in, you know, arguably, both intellectual and moral. You know, if you're going to focus on virtue here, and why is Wilsey better here?
Yeah, a fair question, and a great question. I would say that what I try to do in the book is work assiduously to not come across as this is John Wilsey's view, or this is John Wilsey's program, because I try to root all of my discussion on virtue in 1 Corinthians 13, in Cicero and Aristotle and the classical tradition, which is 2,500 years old, it stood the test of time, as well as in the writings of Augustine and how he takes the classical virtues and demonstrates how they're all expressions of 1 Corinthians 13 charity, the way that Paul describes. The danger there is, just to relativize everything and say virtue, this is your brand of virtue versus this other person's brand of virtue. And I know that you're not doing this in the question, right. but it is an impulse of the left to reimagine, rethink, reassess traditional categories. And they do this with virtue. I was at an event a couple of years ago, in which there was a panel on this very topic on virtue in historical thinking. And the presenters at this panel were waxing eloquent about virtue. And what was interesting about all of them was that they were all on the left. They were all leftist historians. And they were all defining virtue from their with themselves as the frame of reference. So this is how they did it. They said things like, well, I try to come to the historical project with empathy or something like that. I don't remember all the details about what they were saying, but they defined virtue their way. They didn't call on any authority, either religious authority or authority from tradition. They just simply imagined virtue in the way that they saw it. It was totally relativized, totally subjectivized. And that has a history too. I mean, people on the left today are not the first ones to think this. I mean, you can go all the way back to Rousseau and Rousseau's concept of la sensibilité, which is this idea that you exhibit virtue by feeling bad for people in poverty. You don't have to do anything about it, but you have to demonstrate that you feel bad about it. And that's just virtue signaling. That's what we call that now. So there's a continuity in history.
Well, and this goes back to, something about the Robert E. Lee thing that I was thinking about was, I can't remember what book of his it's in, but Bonhoeffer at one point talks about how one way to interpret St. Paul's phrase, "I am the chief of sinners," is that imagine yourself as capable of any sin that someone else has committed. That can be hard to do, right? I mean, I think there is something about the Christian perspective on history that says, and this goes back to the sense of virtue, but also a sense of humility, which is a key part of all of this, is, it's so easy for us to say, look at the quote unquote bad guys of history and say, I would never do that. Really? Again, change the context, change the contingency, change all these other things. Would you do that? Right? Are you sure that back in the 1830s, you would not be a slaveholder? I want to believe with all my heart I would not never be pro-slavery, right? I understand that, but I mean, I'm a sinful person. If I in for you know if I were to make it another 40 years and look back on my life, I'd be like, how did I think that was right? That many decades ago. And so I think there is a sense in which humility is a key virtue here in however we're gonna define this. I'm wondering, and again, I don't want to go through all the theological and classical virtues here, but why, and this is an important question for us at the Ciceronian Society that we just, people like you and me take for granted, but I think it's important to go back to it, is why even bother with these, so-called pagan classical virtues? Why read someone like Cicero as authoritative on the notion of virtue at all? He's not a Christian, obviously, which is not really fair. Jesus wasn't even born yet, but he's, why would we take him seriously? Why take Aristotle seriously? Just because Aquinas did? Well, you and I are Protestants. Do we have to do that? Right? And obviously, I know where this is going, but I'm wondering, I can imagine you getting pushback even in the seminary classroom. Like, why would we look at Cicero for virtue?
Again, fair question. I think there's a couple of ways we can answer that. One, as a conservative, as an aspirational conservative, by the way, that's a plug for my other book that came out last year.
and a previous sower episode, so go back to
That's
that.
right. Amen. I want to revere tradition, and I want to listen to tradition, the category of tradition. Because in tradition, you have ideas and you have patterns of life, patterns of behavior that are articulated that have stood the test of time, that have proven themselves to be worthy of carrying on, of stewarding, of handing down to the next generation. They're blessings to us, even though they're not rooted, say, in a particular Christian figure, or they're not articulated by a Christian. You know, Aristotle wasn't a Christian, Cicero wasn't a Christian. But we're still reading Cicero, we're still reading Aristotle, and Aristotle and Cicero are pillars of our whole civilization. So if we're going to follow that logic, then we're just going to get rid of everything in civilization that doesn't have its root in the Bible, for example. So that's the first thing I would say, is that tradition is important to civilization, who we are, what we believe, how our whole, all of our patterns of life, all of our polity, society, economics are in deep grooves that have been worn down through tradition over the many centuries, thousands of years, and that's valuable. Another thing is that, and I think it's related to tradition, is that God has made a moral law in his world. In other words, that the cosmos has a moral law innate to it, because it's a reflection of God's character as he's the creator of it. If God is the ground of all being, as Augustine said he was, then that means that the created order is going to reflect something of his character, that we're going to have an innate recognition of what truth, goodness, and beauty are, and an innate value for those things. And even though Cicero was pagan, even though Aristotle was a pagan, they're operating off of having been created by the source of all truth, goodness, and beauty. And they can get things right. And someone like Augustine can come down centuries later and demonstrate and show how their ideas about virtue in the classical sense are consistent with and actually are culminated in a virtue that is articulated and is defined in special revelation, namely love and the theological virtues. Mm-hmm.
All right, so we've established that to be a good historical thinker, you need we have these five C's. You need to be virtuous. That's part of it. And then we get to the end of the book. And we have what I would refer to as classic Wilsey here, and it's a description of rightly ordered patriotism, which is going to be it's very prescient. Given how do you say the word semi-quincentennial? So how
I never can get that right. Maybe that's just because I'm. Just like, I'm just a simple guy or something. I can't ever figure it out.
I mean, either 250 years since
250. Of it.
Yeah, I can do the number thing, but this chapter especially hits me. And you and I have talked about this in different ways because I love my country. I love the Constitution, the founders, the Declaration of Independence. We share that. I one of the things I think is going to be a very different. How do I say this? You know, one of the things that the context has changed between the 200th anniversary and the 250th anniversary is that loyalty to God and country has changed dramatically. I mean, the difference in America between 1976 and 2026 is far greater than what most people realize, especially my generation. We can't remember it. And I think, you know, from 9/11 on, you know, so 9/11, you have this astonishing height of patriotism, followed by widespread, especially after the Iraq War, and then just it just keeps going, disillusionment that, you know, growing into a doom spiral, right? And to put it another way, I think a lot of millennials in particular, and then younger, would say, we're willing to die for our family and our home. But when our soldiers go off to war, are they really fighting for freedom and for America anymore? Or are they just fighting for a subset of political elites with dubious motives? There's this deep cynicism that when we get to this anniversary here at the 250th, that we're not celebrating what our parents celebrated in 1976. That there's just something. I mean, is it really what are we celebrating this year? And I think one of the things a virtue of this book, And I don't think you came out and said it this directly, but thinking of what a rightly ordered patriotism is and how better historical thinking impacts it, how does that change the way we think about the 250th anniversary this year? Should we just go into it basically remembering all of America's sins, and especially some of the recent ones, are some of our leaders who have failed us and just frankly have just made us deeply cynical of the entire government? Or should we just, the other side of this would be, let's just ignore all those sins and just go full, I don't know
For
what the word,
America.
yeah, just full America. How does your idea of rightly ordered patriotism help think about this particular moment in American history?
Well, thanks for asking a real simple one sentence.
Well, I have never been easy on you in my life, so I'm just going to keep going.
I appreciate that. I like the way I really do like the way you framed the question, because you're putting your finger on change over time. I mean, your question is a good historical question. Going back to 1976, it was a different time, and people conceived of the country differently. Christians did, and so forth, much differently than now. And you appeal to recent events, the Second Gulf War and War on Terror, and what a boondoggle some of that was, most of that was. And I'm just trying to, come up with a good way to answer your question.
Well, yeah, and
I mean,
I think we need to wrestle with it
but
because
well, let me get to the guts of what I'm trying to say here.
sure.
I think what your question shows, the way you framed it, is exactly what I'm trying to argue in this book, in your kind of triage of our options. None of the options that you gave are good,
Right.
and the options that you gave are all based in historical ignorance. So take someone like Wilfred McClay, good friend of Ciceronian society.
Who just spoke at the conference, which would have just happened. Well, this is going to get published after the conference, but I'm sure he gave it a great talk. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sure he did. This is prophecy here. His book, Land of Hope, which is a U.S. history textbook. You would think that writing a U.S. history textbook would be an easy thing to do, but writing that when he did, what it he was published in, what, 2021, 2020, somewhere
Yeah,
in there.
that sounds right. Yeah.
Not an easy task. He had to thread a needle. He had to be a good historian. He had to approach the historical project like a Christian. He had to be fair to America's glories and America's triumphs, as well as America's sins and America's failures, and come out of that narrative with the thesis that America is a great country. It's not perfect, but it's a good and great country. We can be thankful to God for the heritage that we've received, that our country represents. It's worthy of being handed down unsullied to our children. And good historical thinking is still possible, even in the midst of the chaos that we live with. I love that book. I assign that book in my U.S. history class to my undergraduates. They always really like the book. I get rave reviews of that book from students all the time, every semester that I teach that class. And the antidote, I think, to cynicism and nostalgia, which those are the two choices that you put down. There's probably a lot of antidotes, but one antidote is good historical thinking, virtuous historical thinking. Because what virtuous historical thinking gives us, and I do argue this in the book, is that it gives us knowledge, but not just knowledge. You can have a lot of knowledge and be a cynic and be a nostalgic, but understanding, which is wisdom, about the past. That you can assess the past and look at the past from a mature standpoint. 1 Corinthians 13, when I became a man, I put away childish things. If we look at the past in black and white terms, that's like a child. I mean, that's a simplistic way of looking at it. It appeals to an immature conscience. But taking into account complexity and bringing virtue to the project demonstrates maturity. And we could use a dose of that in our society today, especially as we think about love for country.
I would also add, kind of in closing here, that gratitude is being a big piece of what we should go for. It's so easy to just look at, especially the last, I'd say, 70 years since World War II, and just be like, well, look at all these mistakes we made in policy. The Supreme Court made this decision. It was a disaster. I always joke, when I used to teach constitutional law, I would get to the case of Wickard v. Filburn, and I tell my students, I'm about to lose it here in this, right? I would just get so cynical and dark. I mean, the same thing with other decisions I thought were terrible, like Roe v. Wade.
Right.
I could talk about, you know, stupid wars or stupid decisions by president. I could, the litany of mistakes that we as a country have made. And then
long.
I would, yeah. And then I would remind them, like, the litany of mistakes I've made, well, we're not going to go over those, but let's just say that there's quite a few of them. I could talk about all those things, but we have so much to be grateful for. Just an embarrassing amount as a nation to be grateful for, frankly.
Yeah,
not that
here
we
we are
didn't.
having this conversation remotely.
Yeah.
I mean, this technology that we have, that's such a benefit to us. Our parents in the 70s, in 1976, could not have even imagined something like this.
No.
It's a blessing.
It really is. It really is.
And it comes out of American ingenuity. Amen.
Amen. That's right. I don't know why
I
say.
I mean, Al Gore invented the internet. So
that's right. I
he's
mean,
an American.
thank you
He's
to
an
Al
American.
Gore for inventing. Ciceronian society does not stand by that statement. But I think that's really good. Well, John, before we conclude, any plans for another book? Are you finally done? You're just going to stop writing?
No,
Dang
we're going
it.
to keep on going, man. Just signed a contract with Cambridge University Press to do a volume in the Political Writings of American Statesmanship series, which Carson Holloway and Bradford Wilson edit. I'm doing that with Michael Gonzalez up at the University of Toledo.
Yeah.
And we're doing a volume on John Quincy Adams. So
really? Okay.
we've just signed our contract, and we are just getting started on that project. So very excited about that.
That's interesting. I've never even heard you talk about JQA. That's interesting.
You know, I don't know anything. I'm just going to see what AI can do for us there.
We just know
Pretty
who his
much.
dad. Yeah. Just AI is going to write the book. And
It's amazing what AI can do.
What can possibly go wrong?
Just kidding. Those of you listening, that is not the plan.
I have joked that, yeah, like if I start, like if I were to get back into the habit of like writing birthday cards or like letters to people, I'd probably use AI just to be funny about some things. I had to write, I remember recently I went into one of the AI things and I described my uncle into AI, and I said, write me a poem, a birthday poem for this uncle. And it was hilarious. It didn't make
Really?
any sense. But it was stupid. It was not creative, but it was beautiful in how dumb it was. And so I sent that to my uncle because that's how much I love him. So that's what AI is good for. So,
Yeah,
anyways,
I agree.
well, John,
Totally.
it's always good to talk to you, man. I will have seen you at the conference by now, but I'm looking forward to prophetically, I'm looking forward to seeing you here in a few weeks in Omaha.
Yeah,
So.
same. It's gonna be a great time.
Thanks, man. All right, you've been listening to the Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. If you love God and your country, we hope you'll consider signing up for our newsletter and joining us for a future event. We'll be having our first ever fall symposium in Holland, Michigan in October of this year. Be sure to keep an eye out for more information on that very soon. And please rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, and check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org. Thank you for listening.